about the TechNet. And for those who haven't heard the TechNet before, its major purpose is getting people information, answering questions, and finding out about those favorite rigs and favorite modes and favorite transmission lines and propagation and all these other crazy things about radio. We're going to be probably discussing a little bit of what took place today at the Ham Radio University. I'd also like to discuss what took place in the Thursday issue, January 4th, of Newsday. On the front cover is a subject that is very relevant to radio and human safety. So I think we should be discussing that. The way a person signs into the TechNet is to give me and Mel your call letters, your name, and the confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins this time? Please give me your call letters and name.
Good evening, K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else?
Good.
Kilo Foxtrot 2, Tango Papa, Rick. No.
WS2N with a space report.
Okay, we had a little bit of a double before Rick and Paul we've got. Who is the person who answered, who called before Rick?
W2 Juliet, Papa Whiskey. Lou, yes.
Okay, Lou, one of our frequent sign-ins. So we got Lou, Rich, Paul, Mel. Who else would like to sign in at the TechNet? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2 MDP, Steven, no questions tonight, Dick.
BB2 BXO with a question.
Okay, Mr. BXO has a question. He's a yes. I believe Steve is a no, and Rich is a no, and Lou is a yes. Anyone else like to check in? Give me your call letters and name.
N2GOT, Howard, no.
K2GO, Diane, no.
Okay, we got Diane with no, Howard with no. Any other check-ins? Give me your call letters and names, please. Looks like all these people are resting up after all that activity at the Ham Radio University. Their heads are so big with all that knowledge they got, particularly about loop antennas and ARIES and RACES and ARRL. Okay, Lou, you're number one on the runway. We don't have a whole lot of people tonight. You can take your time. You're allowed to ask us more than one question. You have one, Lou, and two. JPL, I think it is. I've forgotten your call letters, Lou. You know who you are. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Thank you. Okay. I'm just looking at my SWR here. I got two or three interesting comments. So I'd like to see if you or anybody on the net knows anything about this. First one is it's about radio propagation. I've been observing radio propagation on the low frequency bands, 160 and 80 meters, for about the better part of 20 years. I've been thinking lately of the very strange sort of conditions that exist on below 80 meters. During the last sunspot minimum in the mid-1990s, when conditions were about as they are now on the high-frequency bands, 10, 12, 15 meters, etc., with the very low solar flux and so forth, we had enormously good low-frequency propagation. So good, as a matter of fact, that one night I worked somebody outside of London on 160 on phone, talked to him for half an hour. Another night I worked into the Ukraine, which was a lot more difficult, but I did get it. Confirming. She did get a confirmed USO. And we used a beacon station, a radio teletype station that was on 2,063 kilohertz, just above 160 meters. It's a French Navy station. It's FSK, and it's still there. And on many nights during that last sunspot minimum, before this one, in the 1990s, That station was so loud I could hear the power supply ripple on the signal. It was 9 plus. Went to a friend's house and listened on one of his radios, an old A4 that I had sold him, and it was 9 plus there also. Now, during this sunspot cycle, it is hardly ever audible. The station is still operating, and once in a while I hear a burst coming through. And 160 meter DX is a lot poorer, too. Other people have commented that things are not nearly as good. What I'm wondering is, if anybody knows, is there a 22-year cycle on absorption where every other sunspot cycle, the sunspot minimum, would produce very good low-frequency conditions? And it seems to me that that's true for my 50 years of experience in ham radio. But I'm not at all sure whether I'm right. I wonder if anyone knows. Second question is, was a very peculiar phenomenon too I noticed the other day. On 12 meters, there's a station here in Connecticut that has a very good setup. He has a 5-element quad at about 70 feet or more. He was working VKs on 12 meters, two or three of them. And I have a good antenna on that band too, but I'm not quite as high as his, and it's not a quad, but it's a log periodic. Never had anything but great success with it. It's at 50 feet. And, by golly, I couldn't hear anything. Couldn't hear a beep out of those VKs. I can't figure out what should have been such a difference. You, Dick. I wonder if you know anything about any of this. K2RIW and TechNet W2JPW.
As I usually say, a smart person knows what he doesn't know. I use HF so little that I'm pretty ignorant of that one. Part of what Lou was talking about is the 22-year cycle versus the 11-year cycle. Lots of people know that the sunspot cycles go through maxes and mins, the number of sunspots you see on the sun goes in a cycle of 11 years. However, the sun completely reverses its north and south pole every 22 years, or every 11 years it reverses. So you come back to the same magnetic polarity of the sun every 22 years. And if you look hard enough, you will see some definite weather patterns on 22-year cycles. The heat waves that we have in Texas and Oklahoma, for instance, where 5,000 people die, and somehow we don't recognize that as being significant, or 15,000 people die in the suburbs of Paris, France, and this happens on 22-year cycles. And so could there be a 22-year cycle with reference to radio propagation, where the sun doing certain things is lighting up your ionospheric layers, which is good. It's also, particularly in the daytime, capable of lighting up the D layer, which at HF frequencies tends to give you an awful lot of absorption. You try talking to the guy 1 pound over on 80 meters at high noon, when the D layer is absorbing like crazy, it's very difficult. Talk to that same guy at nighttime, and he'll peg your S meter. So, on HF, you're extremely dependent on the ionosphere in ways you are not on VHF frequencies. On HF frequencies, because the noise is so loud on the band, the noise of an antenna looking at the horizon on 80 meters is something like 40 or 50 decibel noise figure equivalent. That's tens of thousands of degrees Kelvin of noise temperature. It's hot. There's thunderstorms going on, all kinds of things. So you can have an extremely sensitive receiver, a real good antenna, and if the ionosphere is there, not there, you're going to get very, very poor propagation on, say, 80 meters and 160 meters. When the ionosphere is there, it gives you a huge signal increase. I mean, if someone told me that the ionosphere is making that signal 90 decibels stronger, I'd believe it. And so that ionosphere is, we're very dependent on it. So, as you can tell, I've told what little bit of knowledge I've got, and I've probably got some errors in it. So you guys guys out there who know a lot more about HF, let's see if you can add to something that Paul is asking. Can you answer his question as to why he sees 160 meters and 80 meters doing such fantastic things during the low portion of the sunspot cycle, but not every 11 years, every 22 years? KQLIW.TechNet, give us your call letters and name right now.
K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else? Okay, Mel and his merry group of guys in Brooklyn, they study propagation like you wouldn't believe. They hold these shootouts in which they test the quality of their antennas so that the combination of good antennas and predictable propagation, those guys do things. You got it, Mel.
Okay, thank you. Good evening. All this is K2KEY. Well, let me tell you about experiences in the last few weeks. I guess I mentioned last week, I brought up about that receiving loop antenna. And I'd like to even discuss that a little further because some idiosyncrasies with that. This past week, give you a for instance, this past week, which is 200, the noise level was just bouncing around somewhere around, anywhere from around, at times, from the best I was getting was S7, the worst, about 5 and over. On my receiving loop with my noise squasher, I was able to bring the noise level down. When it was S7, S8, I was able to bring it down to like S1. And at the worst I had on the receiving loop was, say, about S3 with the noise, maybe S4. I heard a DX station on. This guy, it was operating out of Portugal. And I called him, and he came back to me, and he said, I didn't even know I'd be, I'm being heard in North America. He was as surprised as I was, I guess, that I called him, and then he was surprised that he heard me. I found out now something also very peculiar was going on. On the receiving loop, I was able to hear him really well, but I was tilting the loop. He was running there in Portugal, he was just running a dipole, and I was receiving him on the receiving loop almost at straight up, almost 90 degrees. In other words, the loop was actually standing almost perfectly vertical. A number of other tests this week I made, I was finding that at times I was receiving stations, and I know the antennas they were running. And at times, you would never believe that the receiving loop, a horizontal receiving loop, would be working better on a vertical antenna, vice versa. And other times, it's just the angles I was moving this loop to pick the signals are really unusual. And the most important part of all this is twisting the loop. Not much. I never expected this loop to be as sharp with such nulls as it does have. But a movement of this loop, very little, can make the difference between you receiving the signal and nothing at all. I mean, nothing heard at all. I mean, with very little adjustment on the loop, and so it became extremely critical. And this is only it's only 12 feet of coax cable. This is what I was going to discuss with you, Dick. I haven't been able to really figure out at times. I'm just sitting there in complete awe of what's been happening in the last couple of weeks with this, Dick, over.
Interesting. When it comes to HF antennas, two very big functions are usually not in your control. One is polarization, and the other is angle of takeoff. Well, by way of the ropes and pulleys, the way you can twist your antenna, you can affect angle of takeoff, but not the way you think. Let's go backtrack a little bit now. Polarization. Faraday rotation really means that I can issue a purely horizontal wave. It hits the ionosphere. The ionosphere does what you and I call it a bounce. It's really a refraction. It's really a excitation and re-emission, but because the ionosphere is mixing together the E field of our signal with the Earth's magnetic field, that creates a twist called the Zeeman effect, but give it fancy names if you like. I think Zeeman is spelled with a double E. pure vertical during this hour. And during the hour, the next hour, it can easily shift the number of times. So the ionosphere is really moving around somewhat similar to what you see on a sunny day, and you look at the shadows of the water in your pool, on the bottom of your pool, the so-called scintillation effect. As the minor waves of the air blowing across the water is making waves in the water itself is a refracting surface, and you see bright dim spots moving around in a very nice characteristic pattern on the bottom of your pool when you look through the water. The ionosphere and the atmosphere is doing something similar, more slowly, but it's doing it. So the ionosphere is moving around. The magnetic field is slowly moving around. The amount of Faraday rotation changes. So when you tilt the antenna in various ways and you change it in polarization and see big effects, I can see that. Now, in a case of an 80-meter antenna, even though you've got 270 feet of wire, then it's a really big thing. It doesn't have a great deal of directivity. My definition of directivity is what you get out of a 16-element Yagi. You get something that's like a cucumber in space. In other words, if you could see the three-dimensional pattern of the main lobe of a 16-element Yagi, it would look like a slightly skinny cucumber in three-dimensional space. It's got a certain amount of horizontal beamwidth and vertical beamwidth. You take a one-element loop antenna down at 80 meters, it has an extremely broad pattern, a little bit closer to being a very fat donut. Therefore, the biggest variable you've got when it comes to controlling the pattern is altitude of the antenna above ground. You make minor changes in the altitude of the antenna above ground, and recognize the fact you've got a real antenna above ground, and you've got a mirror image of that antenna below. To your eyes, that ground looks like dirt and grass and things like that. At 80 meters, it's a very good mirror, a slightly foggy mirror. In other words, a mirror with a little bit of mist on the surface, but a very good mirror. So you've got a huge antenna above the ground, the real one, a huge antenna below the ground. They phase together with each other, and the net result is that if your antenna is, let's say, a half wavelength or less above the ground, the vast majority of your signal from that two-element antenna, image and real, that two-element antenna is giving you a nevus antenna, near vertical incident sky wave. In other words, the signal is almost going straight up. And if you look at the amount of signal that's going out to the horizon, it's extremely small. And with minor changes in altitude, although the amount going to the horizon is extremely small, and you raise it a little bit, and you think it's still extremely small, that extremely small signal may have picked up by 10 dB or more. That's my best guess, Lewis, to what's going on with your 12-meter antenna. Even though you're running a log periodic and he's running a cubical quad, and you may think the two antennas are close to the same gain, there could be a significant difference in the altitude of the two of you. Significant might only be 10 feet, but a little bit of difference in altitude and a little bit of difference in the pattern between those antennas. When you start off with a darn small amount of signal on the horizon, where most of it's going straight up, you can get some pretty big changes. So I'm combining what you're saying, Mike, and what Lou is saying. I think altitude is a big factor. Horizontal versus vertical polarization is a big factor. But you would think tilting the antenna would change the pattern. Because the pattern is so broad, tilting the antenna, in my opinion, is doing very little. But when you do tilt the antenna, you're taking the phase center of the antenna and raising it and lowering it above the ground. That's the main thing you're doing. The antenna itself, when you tilt it, I don't think a great deal has happened when you're tilting it in elevation. But you also mentioned that when you rotate it in azimuth, you see some pretty big changes. I'm having more trouble explaining that one. I'm going to pass it back to you, Lou. I'll make a Mel first before we go back to Lou. Give us a couple more words. I think you said you're moving it in azimuth, and you know it's got a broad pattern azimuth, yet with very minor amounts of motion, you see huge decibels of change. I'm running out of guesses on that one. Maybe you've got some clues on that one, Mel. K2KUY, K2RIW in the SICnet.
Yeah, this is K2KUY. Dick, did you ever get a chance to take a look in the antenna manual on receiving loops, the one that they described there, over?
I got great intentions of doing that last week. Got super busy, didn't do it. my antenna manual is at the salt mine, although I do have some other older copies that work, work at home here. So maybe I should go run and get one. Oh, back to you, Mel.
Okay, see if you can find one that has this receiving loop, this 160-meter receiving loop. I made the same version using basically the same formulation, but reduced it to a 80-meter antenna. And basically, it's a thing, it's a frame. I've got 12 feet of coaxial cable on it. I worked out the piece of cable. I think I told you I measured the capacitance per foot on it, the inductance, and put the two together. And the criteria is to stay within less than 0.1 wavelength on 80 meters. And I put this frame thing together. Actually, I thought I would just be able to null out, you know, some of the noises generated here by the Christmas lights. But this thing here, I put it in the shack. It's only 20 feet above the ground. It's up to the old Collin 7584 receiver because I didn't want to take a chance of putting a, you know, an antenna of that sort near a kilowatt transmitter and have possibly have some very high voltage, or high enough, I shouldn't say very high, but high enough voltage to damage the front end of a solid-state rig. So I figured a rig with a, you know, a tube front end can take a little bit more of abuse. I take this receiving loop now. Picture this thing is sitting on an old camera mount, an old camera tripod, so that I have the availability to turn this loop 360 degrees, easy, and to tilt it. Now, I start it out in a vertical position. I turn it. This signal, I can peak the signal of very easy. It's very critical, the amount. I mean, it's only maybe sometimes, 10 degrees makes a difference, tremendous difference. I then adjust the variable capacitor that tunes the inductance, inductive, the LC, inductive capacitance of the loop. And then start to tilt the loop. And by tilting this thing, at times I peak the signals. Now, just by accident, I ran across it listening around the DX band portion of the so-called window, DX window on 75 meters around 37.95 or so. I thought I heard something on the regular, you know, antenna outside, the regular four-wave loop. I thought I heard something, but the noise and everything was too much. I swung the Collins A4 over onto the same frequent listening, and then I heard this guy calling the CP1 out of Portugal. And I did, like I say, I adjusted the loop, turned it, peaked it, tilted it a little bit, and I got him in. I was bringing him in about around S5. He was calling CQ a number of times. I was the only one that came back to him. I was amazed that he was, because the conditions didn't seem to be too favorable to be working Europe. And I've had this experience for the last couple of weeks. I've been experimenting, and I can't understand what's really going on with this loop. I mean, this thing is only approximately 12 feet, you know, in diameter, and it's sitting in a radio shack, in a ham shack, and I question myself, what happens if I made this larger, this loop, by getting a piece of coax that has a lower capacity, distributed capacity per foot than what I used. I just happen to have a roll of RG59 building around, as a lark, I just put this thing together, I can say, and I never expected the results that I'm getting. I mean, it takes me completely by surprise. K2RIW in the TechNet, K2KEY.
Okay, before we pass it back to Lou, loop antenna ideas. Okay, somebody said loop antenna ideas. We're going to get you in a second. Antenna itself is, I think you're using it on receiving only. That makes sense. You don't transmit into it because it's so small and so close to you. And my guess is on that loop antenna, you're not getting huge S-meter reflections. getting very good signal-to-noise ratio. And this is very similar to what happens to the ferrite loop you've got in a AM portable radio. I mean, if you're building a quarter-wave antenna at one megacycle, that would be quite a few hundred feet long as a ground plane. And yes, you'd be really absorbing energy out of the ether with that antenna, and you'd be able to display it on some kind of a power meter or oscilloscope or a spectrum analyzer and so on. Whereas these tiny little loop antennas you've got in a AM radio are not really sucking any substantial amount of power out of the ether as the signal goes by. It just senses the fact that the signal is there. It's picking up, because the antenna is kind of small, it's picking up a small amount of signal, but it's also picking up a small amount of noise, and as long as you've got enough signal-to-noise ratio, the radio is happy. So I'm guessing your receiving loop is running into that kind of a category. We've been keeping Lou waiting here, and he probably wants to add or subtract some of the things to his question. So Lou, N2JPW, K2IW, the TechNet.
Okay, K2RIW, TechNet, W2JPW. Yes, I certainly do. I want to, as usual, I left something out. All of my comments with reference to the propagation on low frequencies applies to 160 meters only. 75 meter DX is just fine. 75 meter DX, although it's considered a low band, has more in common with the high frequency bands like 40 and 20. Whereas 160 is a medium frequency band, and that distinction between medium frequency and high frequency really makes a tremendous difference. Because on 160 meters, you're dealing with something called the gyro frequency, and I think that may be the key to my whole question. I'm answering my own question now, I guess. And what is curious is what you were talking about, the heat waves and things in Texas killing people and all of that, happening on a 22-year basis. Could it be, and I don't have any data on this, maybe I can find it somewhere on the Internet or something with Google, that the gyro frequency changes every 22 years or on a 22-year cycle basis? I guess you know the gyro frequency has to do with the rotation of electrons in the magnetic field, which absorb energy at a terrific rate near usually 1700 kilohertz, and the medium frequency up above the high end of the broadcast band or in the broadcast band depends on geographic location. So that's what I'm really talking about, and there's that French RIDI station that's on 2063. You might want to listen to that one. Listen to that one on that gigantic loop you have. I no longer have a 160 meter antenna. I use my 80 meter for just receiving down there. My 80 meter vertical, which is about 70 feet high, it's an inverted L for 80 meters. So it's not resonant there, which is somewhat of a disadvantage, but it hears fairly well. That's my comment, Dick. I just thought it was a kind of an interesting thing, and if anybody knew, I thought maybe MB might be around. He knows quite a lot about low-frequency stuff, I think. And with reference to the quads on 12 meters, there is something to be said for that, and I'm not sure just what, because all of the antenna books will tell you that there's really no advantage to a quad if you put it up high. Quads are better than Yagis if they're low, when the Yagi is tends to have the ground effect that you were just talking about, and becomes a sort of a quasi Nevis antenna, then the quad works better. But if you put a quad up on a 60-foot tower or pole or higher up, there's supposed to be, according to every antenna book that I've ever read, no real advantage. But a lot of the DXers use them and swear that they work better. And this is what's so strange. See pictures of in the 6-meter handbook. Not a very good book, but it's a book all about 6 meters, The Magic Band, I think it's called. A guy running 15 watts with his quads up on a huge tower. and raving about them. So, I don't know. Maybe there is an advantage to quads that none of us understand. K2RIW and TechNet W2JPW.
N2ND.
And Barry just joined us into Moonbound. Okay. We had somebody who said he had some loop information, and I didn't get his call letters. Would that person please sign in now?
K2RW on the TechNet from Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. Name is John. I just have a couple of thoughts on Mel's situation regarding what he sees as a very critical movement of a loop, or very critical beam width of a loop. Normally, the null in the pattern is very critical, and what he's saying is the peak being very critical. And the only explanation I can think of is he mentioned that the loop is indoors and it's in his shack. So what he might be seeing is the result of the loop receiving a direct signal from wherever it's coming from, and some radiation from local metallic objects, maybe house wiring, maybe his full-size 80-meter loop up in the air might be re-radiating some energy. So he's probably seeing a combination of both of those, and it's making and that effect is what's making the movement of the loop very critical. Normally when the loop is oriented vertically, it's receiving a vertically polarized signal. Mel was saying that he's tilting it around while the ionosphere and polarization changes are probably accounting for some of that too. So it's normal for the loop to have to move around like that to pick up on a signal that's going through many different paths in the ionosphere. K2RAW on the TechNet from KD2BD.
Very fine, John. And I think you're on the head on this one. Many people will tell you that when you use a loop antenna with a other element to it to make it single direction instead of bidirectional, but you're using it as a direction finding antenna. Depending on what environment you're in, the direction finding can become pretty spooky. You might be standing in the marble canyons of New York City and getting reflections off the buildings. Excuse me a second. And the apparent direction can be pretty crazy. Well, inside of a house, our house to us has got nice empty rooms. Well, mine are kind of filled with electronics and stuff, but normal people have empty rooms, and it looks like you got an airspace in the house. In reality, you got all kinds of wiring in the wall, you got plumbing in the floor, you got wiring in the ceiling, you got maybe aluminum siding, you got aluminum gutters. If your eyes were transparent and you could see the radio conductive metallic objects in your house, it would look a little bit more like a pile on the playground. Your house is a complicated thing, and I'm adding some of what I think Mel is running into, and John seems to feel the same way. I don't know if you've ever done very much direction finding, Barry, but I bet you've got things to add to this. And to Moonbound, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, actually I've got more to ask than I have to tell. So if you guys want to beat this around a little more, I'll be patient. I did want to ask you some questions. I made a little progress on my Foursquare antenna today. Being it was my day off, I was able to climb up and down my tower 10 times, and on my roof, 5 or 6. And I made a little progress on it, and I wanted to ask you some questions about that. So let me turn it back to you, and if you want to work on Mel's book a little longer, that's fine by the yoga.
Very fine, Barry. Quite often your rig, you go from the sideband mode back to the FM mode, and you're super loud. Right now, your audio is 15 decibels below what it should be. Sounds like you're talking into the back of the mic. So recheck your mic gain. Is it properly set for the FM mode that you're in now? We'll come back to you. That'll help. Okay. Are there other people that have... Other listeners, people who have anything to add to either Lou's questions or Mel's comments on loop antennas, altitude, 160-meter propagation on 22-year cycle. Anyone who would like to add anything to that, please give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet. think Blue got much of an answer. But he didn't go to the right place. But thank goodness it's not expensive. Don't think he got all his questions answered. I don't think we satisfied him. But, yeah, he's patient. He'll probably hang in there. The next guy who signed in was Frank. And he's also going to tell us what's going on there in Brooklyn. B2BXO, what would you like to talk about, Frank? K2IW in the second half. Hello, Frank.
Hey, just had to get off the phone. Picked up your B2BXO here. Yeah, I did have a question. I know you're interested in, you know, space communications, space phenomena, and I become sort of a fan. You probably know on Tuesday nights on Discovery Science on the Science Channel. Channel reruns the old Cosmos series, the Carl Sagan show. And one thing he mentioned a while back is that at the time he believed with technology that was in development at the time that interstellar travel within the lifetime of human beings, you know, it wouldn't take hundreds and hundreds of years, was possible, say, using a ramjet the size of a planet or something like that. But in any case, Carl Sagan, Dr. Sagan believed it was possible to travel huge distances and that there were technology could be developed that would allow spacecraft, manned spacecraft, to travel at speeds approaching the speed of light and then turn around and gradually decelerate. And the thought occurred to me is, how would a spacecraft traveling those speeds communicate? Because the Doppler shift, it would seem, as you approach relativistic speeds, apart from any relativistic effects, would be absolutely humongous. Would you have to transmit with a laser up in the visual light range in order to have a signal that would be received on Earth down on the HF frequencies or something like that? Maybe I have the Doppler shift backwards, but I think I have it right that the... that you would be greatly redshifted downwards your communication signal. Assuming first of all that given the thousands of years it would pass in Earth times, that there would be somebody to communicate with, what would happen? What would the Doppler shift be as a manned spacecraft, or any spacecraft for that matter, approach relativistic velocities? You know, obviously a way out sort of question, but I thought something you might enjoy playing with. WB2BXO.
That's a good question, Frank. And Paul, our space expert, is going to be adding his comments to it. And that is that you've got it right. When you're traveling away from something, like the Earth receiving antenna will see a longer wavelength or a lower frequency. They go together, of course. And so it's a so-called redshift. And the best example we've got of that, and you can easily get a copy of it on the Internet, in various Sky and Telescope astronomy magazines, and many other journals. You can look at the Hubble Deep Field photograph, or the Hubble Ultra Deep Field photograph. And just to review that, someone decided that the sky is pretty empty and blank and black, pretty close to the Big Dipper. So a little bit off to one side of the Big Dipper, where there's almost nothing to see. They aimed the Hubble in that direction and integrated the picture for 1 million seconds, which is what, 1/30th of a year, which is, 2 weeks worth or so. So for a million seconds, they integrated, and what you saw in the picture is 2,600 galaxies that had never been seen before. In other words, there ain't no empty space. Yeah, there may be a lot of dim stuff, that may be the direction where a lot of things are moving away real fast, but boy, there was a lot of stuff there. Each galaxy, on general, it contains 10 to the 10 to 10 to the 11 suns, stars, which is, 100 billion stars, something like that. in the average galaxy and 2,600 galaxies. Well, a number of those galaxies have an extreme redshift. They are so far redshifted that they're hard to see. And one of the things that you'll see as an extremely interesting chapter in the reference data for radio engineers, the space communications section. That may not be the exact title, but there is a chapter giving you a lot of information about satellites and whatever. And one of the factors we all forget about is that when you're moving away, you may be issuing with your transmitter 1 million cycles per second, but you move fast enough and the guy is only going to get 500 cycles per second from you. And at first you say, okay, it's a lower frequency and a longer wavelength. There's another catch. There's really a pipeline between the Earth and you as you move away, and that pipeline is getting longer and longer. There's more and more energy in the pipeline. The bottom line is that the amount of signal strength you see on Earth decreases as you move away fast. Not only is it redshifted, you're getting a fewer number of cycles, so you see a lower frequency, but of the energy transmitted, less and less of it is getting to you per second. So you get a lower amount of power. So if you do an exact calculation of how many watts has to be on that satellite so you can talk, you've got to put more watts in there if you're going to move away real fast. So correcting the frequency, well, you got the right idea. Transmit a laser beam and it'll get shifted all the way down to radio frequencies. Yeah, that's possible. And it's a beautiful way to go because the laser beam can be so very nicely aimed. And you better aim all that energy right at the Earth because there's a lot of free space loss there. And if you want it to be above threshold, it better be very well aimed and it better be a potent beam. So laser's a good way to go. But there's one thing you cannot compensate for, and that's time delay. The nearest star is 4 light years away. The star you want to go to might be 150 light years away. So a round trip QSO, even if you're not moving, would be 300 years. So that's an unusual QSO. So communicating with Earth, you've got multiple problems. If you're moving at a relativistic velocity, your clock says everything is normal. The clock on Earth will seem to be moving faster. When you finally turn around and come home, you'll be talking to your great-grandchild instead of your son. You get that crazy shift. So Carl Sagan may have hinted that interstellar space travel is going to happen in a small number of lifetimes. I'm very skeptical. And the main reason I'm skeptical is not only the distance is so vast. And let me, you've heard that little puzzle of mine, scale model. When Spirit and Opportunity landed on Mars, Mars was roughly 300 million miles away on the other side of the sun. A nice number, rolls off the tongue real easily. We know it's big, but we don't know how big it is. But Mars is half the size of the Earth. And I looked around the house and said, what have I got that's 2 to 1 in size? And the answer is a 50-cent piece and a dime. They're very close to 2 to 1 in size. So if 50-cent piece represents the Earth, and if the dime represents Mars, how far would you put upon the 50-cent piece and the dime to represent the scale distance? I've asked that to lots of engineers, and they usually say half a table, full table, or a great big conference table required. The answer is half a mile. 50-cent piece and dime have to be half a mile apart for it to be scaled to the distance. So what NASA did is they took off from the 50-cent piece on the Earth, and they landed on the right letter at the right angle of that dime half a mile away. And Earth and Mars are the dense portion of this solar system. You get out near Jupiter and Uranus, Neptune, and whatever, where it's really sparse and there's great big spaces, the model almost breaks down. So the distances are so vast, the problems are so, the energy requirements are so huge, and the biggest one of all is the consumables. The guy named Frank, who lives in Brooklyn, he's a normal guy, eats the normal amount of food, he drinks the normal amount of water, and uses the normal amount of oxygen. But I'll bet you each one of the people in the Grossman family consume in 1 year an amount of water, food, and air oxygen that would fill up the volume of your house and would have the mass of your house. That's what you consume in a year. One house holds worth of volume